Hello there, Casterbus Podcast with a K listener. My name's Christian Courtley and I'm the editor. With me are James McLean and Brian Terranova. Hello, chaps.
Hello.
Hello.
And this week's podcast, we'll be talking about BBC Worldwide's various events that they've been running since Doctor Who returned in 2005. The long-running fans among you may recall that during the 80s, and particularly during the 90s and the early 2000s, there was very little in the way of Doctor Who related events other than Blackpool and Longleat. Since Doctor Who returned in 2005, we've had conventions and exhibitions and touring exhibitions, and we've even got live theatre productions, which we'll be talking about a little later on with Tom McRae, who's written Crash of the Elysium. But before we get on to Tom, chaps, it's clearly driven by Doctor Who's popularity and presumably with BBC Worldwide being involved in these things, one eye on driving a profit. But there isn't really that much different going on with these events, these exhibitions, Crash of the Elysium aside, and conventions to what we saw in the 1980s, is there, do you think?
They're on a grander scale, I would say. Mm-hmm. What other events are you talking about, though? I mean, like, we've got conventions and they've got signings and so on, and those things certainly happen. But what else is there aside from plays? They even did plays. Why is Crash of Elysium so different?
Well, I'm specifically leaving that aside because it's interactive.
So I see.
It's basically a play. It's more of a thing that you go through.
Okay. I guess you're right, though. I can't think of anything else.
Yeah. So, if it is... is it just something that's based entirely on Doctor Who's popularity? Hmm. Or is it more to do with building Doctor Who's popularity? Or is it somewhere in between?
You know, it probably is a lot more to do with their popularity, because if you think about it, before, a lot of the events were fan generated.
Yeah.
You know, whereas now they've actually got an official Doctor Who convention going on.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
And they're actually making them make trips to New York. You know, the actors while the TV show is current.
Yeah.
But then you've also got a far more I don't want to say Americanized, but perhaps a little more of a slick media in the UK now than there was in the 80s, where especially with Doctor Who, where I don't think Doctor Who in the 80s was considered a flagship as it is.
Well, part of the problem with that could have been the fact that BBC was just god-awful at promoting its own stuff in the 1980s.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's still not exactly brilliant in a lot of ways, but it's a far more together, it's a far more contemporary, and it has to be. Now it's got so much competition. It can't be the single, you know, have the single rival. Yeah. I mean, in the 60s, it'd have been interesting. Obviously, if we look at the 60s and what was happening in the 60s, I suppose with Dalek Mania to a degree, would perhaps be a good comparison, just basically because you've got a show which was becoming a flagship in the 60s for the BBC, especially for its kids, as it is now. Since 2005, there's no doubt it is one of BBC's leading flagships by the 80s. It was sort of seen by the BBC as something which, you know, was just part of the mantelpiece, I got the impression.
Yeah.
You know, but here's a question for you guys, because since you bring it up, and I know you almost just answered this, James, but do you think that the original series ever had that flagship potential and the BBC just didn't have the faith in it? Or do you think that it had a long way to go because of, like, the budgets that it had and the treatment that it was getting from the people making it?
I don't really think there was such a thing as flagship in the 60s and 70s. I mean, there's things we can compare it to, but I don't think the BBC ever had that mindset that here is one specific programme that is head and shoulders above the rest in its area. I mean, if they did, it was probably something like Grandstand on a Saturday, or perhaps a specific short-term drama, particularly in the 1960s. Perhaps in the 1970s, there's more of a focus on the Saturday night. But I don't think they really had a flagship. I don't really think that's a term that was used then, is it? James?
It's a good question. I think the shows which they would have considered flagship, I think in the 80s they would have considered EastEnders a flagship. The shows.
Well, not Howard's Way.
That's a good question. I must admit, I think flagship has always been a show which you put a lot of backing behind, and is something that you're very happy to corporately stand behind as an example of your quality of your entertainment and your And I think the flagships in the 80s were slightly, or would be now considered to be a little odd. I mean, obviously, Morecambe and Wise would be an example of a flagship in the 70s.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's no doubt about that. So it's those leading shows. And even though Doctor Who, even in the 80s, up until hitting the Coronation Street and the, or perhaps even the turbulent 86 period, was still hitting fairly high figures, I don't think it was really considered by the BBC. I still think they were sort of slightly bemused by it, but I think they're more savvy now. And obviously, I think also the fact that the way the television audiences have changed, and people are now far more openly geeky and open to make geek cool, if you see what I mean. I think that's meant that there's a lot of people have seen the potential and feel a little more relaxed that what they're dealing with isn't just silly trash. It's silly trash that people like will embrace. I think there's that factor in there.
But there had to have been shows that were more popular than others, that were a bit more heavily promoted than others. I mean, even, I don't know if necessarily, maybe they did have the term a flagship show here in the 60s. I don't recall, but I just know that some shows got more attention. Some shows are the ones that people were constantly talking about and wanting to see them make more of. So while the term may not have existed, I just wonder if Doctor Who could have had that potential if the show promoted it perhaps to the right audience rather than where they were trying to leave it.
Yeah. Well, I think that sort of gets us into Keith Miller's story of the official Doctor Who fan club sort of territory, where this is a 13-year-old boy who was tasked with the job of running the official Doctor Who fan club. Wow. In the 1970s, and he had a bit of help from the Doctor Who production office, which was mainly for printing and postage. And there's this thing about the BBC being pretty much an old boys club, isn't there? And like in terms of how people get jobs or get put in charge of programs, I really don't think there was any recognition. I mean, you only have to look at the state of the, you know, which episodes are left and which ones got trashed and which ones got sold abroad and which ones got returned and all that sort of thing, to recognize that they really didn't have a clue about. And I don't think this is true of exclusively with the BBC. I just think television companies in general didn't really have that much of an appreciation of the commercial potential of their programs beyond selling copies to other countries. If you look at public appearances, there's William Hartnell did public appearances, didn't he, on the back of little carts. I think there's a thing on 30 years in the TARDIS, or more than 30 years in the TARDIS, of him at an air show with some giant Dalek dragging him along on the back of a sort of runway train or something. And you know, you've got the usual, you know, turning of John Pertwee or Tom Baker throughout the 70s at various events, or you know, switching on of lights and things like that. But you know, besides these two key exhibitions at Blackpool and Longleat in the 1980s, you know, people from around the country, kids from around the country, were wanting to go to these two places to see the exhibition. So it just baffled me that there wasn't more of a focus on this early on. Although, you know, there's two ways of looking at it. I mean, the other week when I was at the Doctor Who convention, and I asked Matt Smith and Steve Moffat and Arthur and Karen the question of how have you felt about today? At the back of my mind, there was that aspect of, well, they've done all this already in America. Is this really that much different to them? So there's...
I think I know what you mean. There's maybe to a certain degree, the change isn't just so much in the perception of the show, but in, as I was sort of trying to say earlier, not really forming it right, in the perception of the culture. Because in the 80s and the 70s, there weren't any conventions in Britain, period, really. I mean, fans would get together and meet.
Yeah.
But it wasn't like there is now, and where you've only got to look through sci-fi magazines and you'll see the basic collectomania stuff, you know, the sort of basically the fan stalls with a few guests on a table, to proper conventions for things like Buffy and Stargate, and it's Doctor Who obviously as well. And the conventions are now a far more widespread established medium, and with Doctor Who so firmly thrust at the moment, probably more so than it has been since the 60s, as a in that family niche where kids absolutely adore it and adults absolutely adore it, I suppose the convention thing seems very sensible. And I think maybe also the other fact is that they've made successful headways into other mediums, like the video game industry. Okay, they've had a couple of but they've had some reasonable stuff come out, like the BBC Online games. They were quite popular. You know, books, comics, they've done cartoons, they've got audio plays. There's a whole plethora of showing the Doctor Who works on so many levels. Maybe the BBC as well, and especially BBC Cardiff, are very confident behind it to treat it like a in a way that in the 80s there wasn't these sort of there was this evidence that it could sort of extend so far outside its boundaries, outside its safety zones. Maybe that's a factor.
Yeah, that could be it.
It is interesting, too, when you think about it, like TV shows like Doctor Who or Star Trek or so on will get these kind of conventions that their actors kind of, I don't know if they necessarily, if obligated is the right word, but they get the option to attend, or it becomes something that I took this role, this is something that I do now. Whereas other TV shows, you know, we talked about House before and other TV shows like it, you know, they just, the actors just get to do their job and go home at the end of the day, you know. People still want to get their picture with them because they're celebrities, period. But they don't drive this kind of secondary world of conventions or meet and greets and signings and so on like that. So it is interesting that the show has that kind of power and this kind of treatment that they would do conventions or plays or all of this kind of extra advertising for it.
Do you think that scares potential stars off then?
I do think, honestly, it could, because I do know that some of the actors out there, they do not like it. Some people are extremely private, and while they want to do the acting job, they're just private people, and they really would prefer to be left alone. And unfortunately, when you go anywhere near the sci-fi realm, if you do anything that's you know, a hit in any way or a cult thing in any way, you definitely cannot be left alone. It's like if you make it to an A-lister actor, you're going to have that issue no matter where you go. But if you get into this sci-fi cult niche, you know, nowhere you go is safe.
Yeah.
You know, and yeah, I do think it would drive some people away, because some people would look at that and say, I really don't want that attention. And I think, honestly, that could be potentially an issue that Christopher Eccleston had. Because yeah. I know he doesn't necessarily like the attention. And he doesn't like when people ask him about it.
I've actually had fans actually say to me, well, you know, they better come and do these conventions, you know, unlike, you know, even Eccleston, because they owe us for making their careers. And that sort of really bugs me, in the sort of fact that they don't owe you in having to sell a part of themselves that they don't want to. They don't have to whore themselves at conventions. They don't owe you that. They can owe you your gratitude for watching and be pleased that you like what they do. But they no more owe you an appearance at Doctor Who than they owe, you know, appearances from other shows they've done.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure Chris Eccleston had quite a good career before Doctor Who and since Doctor Who. So,
right.
Yeah.
But it's such a rude, to me, it's a bit of a rude approach to...
Yeah.
If someone does a convention or a signing, like, for instance, the other day I went to see the band They Might Be Giants, and they did a signing afterward.
Were they or were they?
Yes and yes.
Oh, cool.
No, but... The signing afterward, I looked at it as just, this is brilliant. I get to meet these guys. I get to thank them for all the entertainment they've given me over the years, listening to their music. And this is such a cool thing that they did. I didn't sit there and say, like, you have to sign everything that I brought. You guys owe me for buying all your music. And this signing is what I expected. That's asinine. I mean, if they're going to do this, it's an extra thing that should be, like, just extremely appreciated by the people that go to see them. But you're right, I have met people who felt the same way.
It's comic book guy, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. But I've met people who were like, Eccleston better do the 50th anniversary. He owes it to us. Like, no, he
exactly,
doesn't.
But
it was a job. I mean, if he does it, awesome. If he doesn't do it, hey, it's his life. You know?
Precisely. It does frustrate me, that. It really does.
Yeah, but and I can certainly understand his point of view. I mean, he does. You can see him in interviews. Like some of the ones for Confidential, he seemed like he was totally into it. But when he's in an interview outside the Doctor Who realm, he kind of seems a little uncomfortable. And it just kind of seems like, you know, I'm done with this. And I don't blame him. You know, I mean, it was a one-time job, and he definitely, like I said, he definitely strikes me as that private kind of person. I mean, I really hardly hear much about him except connected to the Doctor Who realm. You know, I mean, his projects, certainly, his work, yes, but I don't hear much about, like, the gossip or something. He kind of, like, flies under the radar a lot.
Okay, we're going to move on now to another Doctor-related big event. Last year, the crash of the Elysium took place in Manchester. It is a... I'm going to be careful how I describe this. It's a live interactive piece of theatre. I'm going to leave it there because we're going to move on to an interview now with Tom McRae.
So we're chatting about Crash of the Elysium, which has moved from Manchester to Ipswich. Is that right?
That's right, yes. It was when we put the show on in Manchester, we had various different backers, and one of them was the Olympic 2012 mm-hmm. committee or commission or whatever they are, who very kindly gave us some cash, and part of the deal was that we would then bring it back as part of the 2012 Cultural Olympiad in a location out of London. So it's part of their commitment to bringing exciting events that benefit the whole country rather than just being a London-centric thing. And so we've come back for our second leg to be part of that.
Now, it's an interactive production, isn't it?
Well, it's not. When you say interactive, it kind of makes it sound like a cool museum where you get to press buttons and dinosaurs roar. It's not that it's an interactive show. It's that when you're in it, you don't realise you're in a show. It looks like you've just walked into a Doctor Who version of real life.
Right.
And you are in an episode.
Yeah.
You get to star in your own episode of Doctor Who. The interactivity kind of implies that there's sort of performers and you're somehow not in there, but you're sort of just touching them, with which you are the stars of the show. So it's just not like anything else. We don't really have words to describe it. But I'm sure in future years people will say, oh, it's like the Crash of the Elysium,
sure.
And then people will get it. But for the moment, we've sort of invented something brand new. And really, the best way to understand it is just to come and see it, because it is really amazingly good.
If I was to say, is it like, for instance, is it like going around York Dungeons?
The thing is, if you do that, you go along to a thing that says York Dungeons, and you buy a ticket that says York Dungeons on it, and you will see some like security guard and a health and safety person.
Yeah, yeah.
When you turn up, everyone is in character.
Right.
You will never see a Doctor Who logo anywhere.
Uh-huh.
You arrive to see an exhibition called The Crash of the Elysium, and everyone you meet there is museum staff. And then it all kicks off. You'll never see the drawings. The point at which we always call it going down the rabbit hole.
Mm-hmm.
You have a kind of a buffer sequence at the front which takes you into the story, takes you out of the real world and into our world. And that is the museum exhibition. But you won't ever see the drawings. And if you take kids along and don't tell them it's a show, as far as they're concerned, they've just had a real thing happen to them.
Yeah.
And actually for the adults as well, it is entirely, it's actually immersive is the word that Punch Drunk used to describe their shows.
Yeah.
But unlike other Punch Drunk shows, this actually has a driving narrative. Normally with Punch Drunk, you have the freedom just to explore randomly around the kind of story, and you may see things, you may not. With this, we've structured it like an episode of Doctor Who. It has a beginning, a middle, and an end. It has a big twist in the middle. It has a ticking clock, really exciting sequence at the end. And it's everything you'd expect from, you know, your Saturday night brought to life.
Okay. Now, you did mention earlier when people in the future start going down this path of be looking back and saying it's like the Elysium. Did you get to see the production of Midnight in Manchester last year?
The production of Midnight? You mean the
Doctor Who episode?
Yeah. No, I didn't realise that had been done.
Yeah, there's a pub in Manchester which is run by a Doctor Who fan. You may know him, Gareth Cavanagh, who does the Warp Warp fanzine. And,
right.
And he hosted a production of Midnight for about 7 nights. Phil Collinson and Russell T Davies were involved early on, so it was completely lucid in that. And that had a very close quarters audience. It's basically a very small room, so the whole set was done out like the inside of the line.
Yeah.
And you had the audience at either side, so it was very close. And people at the time, someone that was there had been to the Elysium and said that, although the Elysium was like completely different, it reminded them of that, being that very close into the action.
Yeah. Well, I think, if you go and see them, I do see quite a lot of theatre. And there's a lot of experimental stuff which does that. And I think because we all grew up with TV and film, we're used to slightly sitting back from the action, letting the professionals take charge.
Yeah.
There's actually a lot of theatre. I mean, if you look at Panto as a kid and, you're shouting at the actors and they drop in and out of character and, there's catchphrases. And actually theatre is, when it's good, it is pushing boundaries and doing all these different things. So by no means has the Elysium or this production of Midnight, we're not unique in that we do things that blur the boundary with the audience. I think the difference with the Elysium show is that because Felix, who directed it, Felix Barrett, who is the creative genius behind Punch Drunk, and that's not a word I use lightly, but he really is,
right.
What we've done is just, it's the slickest, most incredible version of that. And to distinguish between, although I didn't see the production of Midnight, I can imagine from your description how it would work, there is still an audience.
Yeah.
With us, you are the people
are.
In the,
on
the Sapphire Diamond, the name of the planet. And it is, it's very much for the kids. Although adults will love it too. And we are also doing After Dark shows this year, which we did a few last year. This year we're doing a few more, and we're kind of planning them a bit more in advance. And they'll really, really appeal to the adults. It's essentially the same show, but with the scares ratcheted up a bit. And then there's the family shows as well, which everyone can come along and enjoy.
Been at Manchester, now it's at Ipswich. And the way you describe it, with, you know, the immersion, the immersive nature of it, has the script developed over the between the two times, or developed while it was at Manchester in order to accommodate?
Well, it's different. Every show is different.
Right.
I wrote it as a script,
mm-hmm.
and so that everyone had a document to work off. I wrote it like a TV screenplay, and then because the main characters are the audience, and we don't know what they're going to do.
Sure.
I mean, there's certain parameters, like we're not inviting people to kick holes in the set. They have to go through the door that's in front of them. But you know, other than that, it's really this such as freedom, and you don't know what they're going to say or do or ask. So the actors then workshopped it endlessly. To come up with, you know, just basically I wrote the version of the story that had every single bit of facts and information in it. So the actors had all that at their disposal,
yeah.
with the expectation that no performance would require them to do all of these things.
Right.
But it meant that they were prepared for any eventuality. Then I was around for the rehearsals in Manchester. I was there for the whole track period for that. And literally the actors would just fire questions at me. We all became very good friends, and most of them are coming back for the Ipswich show, so they'll know it. But I went round the show 13 times when it was on in Manchester. I've seen it more than anyone else. And I went round with the groups. I wasn't just watching from the side.
Mm.
And each group would be sort of shepherded around by more than one actor. And the actors would be put into sort of pairs or threes. And each pair or each three would have their own version of that show. And okay. then one of them would have a nice little idea and the others would hear about it and that'd get picked up. And so it was very much... a collective, collaborative thing, and they're all doing like 16 shows a day, something like that. So it very quickly starts to take on a life of its own.
Mm-hmm.
And Felix and I were always around, but we let it, you know, run free and be itself. And that's one of the reasons it was so exciting, was because it was always so different.
Now then, in an ideal moral world, should the Doctor have embraced the Amy that was, rather than trying to find the Amy that he wanted?
Well, he gets... The point of the ending is that by saying the young Amy, he gets old Amy as well.
Yeah.
Because they have to wait 36 years to have her.
Sure.
And so there's no real... I mean, it's hard to make a moral case for something that's so utterly impossible.
Yeah.
That could just never, ever happen. But I think he made the... I think he made the right choice. It'd be... I don't think Marcus or Caroline or Skinner would be very pleased if Amy had to spend, or Karen had to spend 2 hours in makeup every morning to stay old Amy for the rest of the run. So there's a practical consideration there. But yeah, I think it was there was a line actually originally in the script which I cut. And when I saw Gareth Roberts at the launch, he said to me, "Oh, my favourite line in the script was," and he quoted the line that I cut, which I now wish I'd kept, which was the Doctor at the end saying, "There's no such thing as right and wrong. There's just wrong and less wrong."
Right.
So that's my argument for why he did the right thing.
Okay, the other question right. was about the Cybermen, because obviously you brought them back in 2006,
okay.
and since then we've seen them sporadically, but we haven't seen them, you know, really going for it. Would you like
yeah.
to see them coming back and really going for it, rather than maybe just getting destroyed in the before the pre-credits?
Well, you're asking me about the future of the show there. I'm going to say that
okay.
I think that they are wonderful returning villains, and that there's always, when you've got someone as clever as Stephen Moffat
yeah.
running the show, there will always be a facet to even the most familiar thing in Doctor Who that he will find that no one's done before.
Mm-hmm.
And when he does decide to do a massive, great big Cyberman story, or a massive, great big Yeti story, or the day the sonic screwdriver became the baddie, or, well, that's quite a good idea, actually, I should do that. but anyway, he will find the most amazing way of doing it. So I have absolute confidence that the next brilliant Cyberman story is not going to be,
okay.
you know, it's going to be very, it's going to be a lot of fun when it does come along.
Okay. Is there anything...
Are you going to be coming along to the...
Right. I think my co-podcaster, James, will be coming across. Because I'm in the northeast and James is in Norfolk already, so he doesn't have to go.
Too far.
I believe that's all been arranged. So I would like to, but I think it's probably going to be James.
Well, it is worth coming along. And if anyone is listening and hasn't got their tickets yet... I can't wait to see it again. I'm going along. In fact, I won't say when I'm going along because I'm taking half a cast from Doctor Who with me. So anyone who does end up in our group will have a fun night because we are just turning up with a normal group. But yeah, I can't wait to see it again. And it really is the most amazing thing I've ever been involved with. And if you haven't seen it, you can't understand quite how good it is unless you go and see it. And bear in mind, I wrote it and I still saw it 13 times without getting bored once.
Yeah, excellent. Okay, well, Tom, thanks very much for talking to us.
Thank you very much, and I hope you do get a chance to come down and see us.
That was Tom McRae, and what a really nice guy he was. I really enjoyed speaking to him. And has it been confirmed that he's writing an episode? I'm not sure if it has or not. I'm pretty sure it hadn't been when I spoke to him.
I haven't heard.
I have to ask the editor of Casterbrus. He should know.
He should know, shouldn't he? Yes, I'm just getting my timelines mixed up. So that's the end from this week's Casterbrus podcast with a K. I've been Christian Corley. These two chaps have been my assistants, Brian Terranova and James McLean. And we'll be back next time, dear listener. Goodbye.
I miss Vindicae.
Vindicae.
I think we should make that be a staple from now on. This has been your Casterbrus podcast, Vindicae.
When did that start?
I did it one time. One time I did it in a podcast, and we've never seen it again. I miss it.